From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Willie Nelson has been one of the biggest names in country music for years, despite the fact that he's often gone against the Nashville image. Willie Nelson talks about his music and his life on this edition of Fresh Air. We also speak with those insatiable chroniclers of true American cuisine, Jane and Michael Stern. The Sterns have logged over 1,000,000 miles, sampling the cooking at roadside diners, taverns, truck stops, cafeterias, and barbecue pits. Performer-in-residence Harry Connick Jr. returns to play a couple of tunes for us. And television critic David Bianculli catches us up on the new fall TV season with capsule reviews of a half dozen new shows. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Willie Nelson is one of the superstars of country music. He reached that status with songs, a vocal style, and an image that broke the Nashville mold. Nelson says that if you've ever seen an Indian Head Nickel, then you know what he looks like in profile with his hair down. Willie Nelson's best-known recordings include Always On My Mind, Let It Be Me, and On the Road Again, which crossed over to the top 20 on the pop charts. But many of the songs he wrote were famous long before he was. Back in the late 50s and early 60s, other singers had hits with his songs Crazy, Funny How Time Slips Away, and Nightlife. Nelson had to make a living through such jobs as selling vacuum cleaners and encyclopedias door-to-door, working as a radio DJ, and teaching Sunday school. Now his successes include 5 Grammys and 8 Country Music Association Awards. 23 of his records have gone gold or platinum. He's also starred in the films Barbarossa, Songwriter, and Honeysuckle Rose. Willie Nelson chronicles his life in the new autobiography, Willie. And he has a new record of standards. The record's called What a Wonderful World. Before we meet him, let me play you an excerpt of the new album. This is Moon River. Willie Nelson from his new album, What a Wonderful World. Willie Nelson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Since you've just written an autobiography, let's go back to your early childhood when you were growing up in Texas, and most of the people around you were picking cotton, and I think you worked in the cotton fields when you were young. You knew you didn't want to do that as an adult. Did that help motivate you to write songs and to sing and become a performer?
Well, definitely. I knew early in life that I didn't want to be a professional cotton picker. I knew music had to be better. I would work on the side of the highway there in Abbott and see these air-conditioned Cadillacs driving by. And for a 10-year-old kid, it gave me a way to go there. I said, well, these guys must know something I don't know.
Were you exposed to a lot of different music of people singing, from people singing in the cotton fields?
Yeah, there was a lot of black singers in those days and picking cotton and... sometimes it wouldn't be unusual for be 25, 30, 40 pickers in the field. And, of course, they would sing those old great old blues songs, and they would write them on the spot. It sounded like one would do a verse or a line from across the field, and someone would answer him from across the field on the other side. And sort of like having your own opera there in the cotton fields.
Your grandfather died when you were young, and your parents divorced when you were young. By the time you were age 7, you said you were writing cheating songs after your parents divorced. And you said that you were writing these cheating songs before they could actually be sung in Texas. What kind of unspoken rules were there where you were about what songs were okay to sing?
We could sing any kind of songs we wanted to. It was a little bit, I think, different for a kid of 9 and 10 years old to be writing and singing cheating songs. Obviously, I hadn't done a lot of running around on anybody at that age. But, of course, if you believe in reincarnation, then there's possible that I'm writing about some other time.
And you do believe in reincarnation?
Yes.
You said that when you were young, you saw Hank Williams' songbook, the Johnny Mercer songbook, the Hoagy Carmichael songbook. So by the time you were 8, you thought you should have one of those songbooks of your own. What were your songs like then, the ones that you compiled when you were 8 years old and into the Willie Nelson songbook?
Well, of course, back then I thought they were fantastic. Today, looking back on them, they're not really, I don't think there's probably not a Stardust among them, but...
Do you remember them all?
I remember them, yes.
When you were young and getting started, you played a lot of barrooms, and you played through a lot of barroom brawls, through stabbings and shootings. What was your technique when all hell would break loose? Would you duck or just keep playing?
Just keep playing longer and louder. And I remember one time in Dallas, it hadn't really been that long ago, that we had just started the dance, the music had just started. It was about 10 o'clock at night. And we just started playing Whiskey River, and the fight broke out. So I said, well, we'll just play until they quit fighting. And we played and played, and they fought and fought, and we played and played, and they fought, and here come the police. So I finally said, wait a minute, this show is over. So we broke down and got out.
Did that teach you not to be fazed by an audience, no matter how they respond?
Sort of, yeah. I think I've seen all kinds of audiences. Naturally, the ones who sit and quietly and listen to what we're doing are the ones who get up and dance and have a good time are the ones I like better.
Willie Nelson is my guest, if you're just joining us, and he's written a new autobiography titled Willie, and he also has a new record of standards called What a Wonderful World. You established yourself as a songwriter before your reputation spread as a singer, and in your early days as a songwriter, you were royally ripped off. I don't know whether you think of it that way or not, but for instance, your song Nightlife, you sold that for $150, and it went on to be recorded by around 70 artists. It sold 30 million records over the years. How did it come to be that you sold that song for $150?
I also sold another song, Family Bible, that along during the same period of time. I was in Houston, and I was married, had my kids there, and we were looking for a place to stay, and I needed some rent money. When I first hit Houston, I stopped by a club called the Esquire Club, and it was on a Monday afternoon, and there was a band rehearsing in there. And I said, well, maybe I can apply for a job here or sell some songs or something. So I introduced myself to the band leader, a guy named Larry Butler, and told him that I was a guitar player and songwriter, and asked him if he had a job open in his band, and he said, no, he didn't. So I said, well, you're looking for any songs? And he said, well, I don't know. He was recording at the time. And so I started singing him songs, and he said, well, those are pretty good songs. What do you want me to do, record them or what? And I said, no, I want to sell them to you. I'll sell them to you for $10 a piece. And I'd done him 8 or 10 songs, and he said, no, he said, I'm not going to buy those songs from you because they're too good of songs to sell for $10 a piece. But he said, I will loan you some money. So he let me have $50, and that was enough to put my family in get us an apartment for the week and buy a few groceries. And I never did forget that man. He's still a good friend of mine. I still see him quite often, him and his wife, Pat, and we still talk about that, he didn't buy those songs. He missed out on a good deal.
So who did buy Nightlife, and what's the story behind that?
Nightlife I sold, actually for $100, I sold it to friends of mine, Claude Gray, Paul Buskirk, and Walt Breland, and it took all three of them to come up with $100, and those are the same guys I sold Family Bible to. So it kind of stayed in the family.
Did you get a songwriting credit, or did they buy that from you as well?
In the beginning, I didn't get the credit. Later on, a few years later, I started getting credit for it. I started getting my name back on the record.
You used the money that you got from Nightlife to fund yourself to go into the studio and record the same song. What happened to your recording of it?
Oh, it wound up, probably didn't sell four copies. It was, I thought, a pretty good recording back in those days. Paul Buskirk was in the band. Herb Remington, one of the finest steel guitar players alive, used to work with Bob Wills. He was living in Houston at the time, and I had some of the best musicians in town. We did the record, and it turned out well, but it just was one of those small labels, and it didn't sell.
As you became a little more established as a songwriter, did you still get cheated out of songwriting credits or royalties, or did you learn how to avoid that from keep that from happening?
Well, fortunately, when I got to Nashville, I met some people. Hank Cochran was one, and Hal Smith of Pamper Music in Nashville and Goodlettsville, and I started writing for Pamper Music, and it was a good publishing company. Their accounting was honest, so I lucked out there. A lot of writers haven't been that fortunate, but I lucked out and got hooked up with a good, honest organization to begin with.
You went to Nashville in 1960, and when you got there, Patsy Cline recorded your song Crazy, and I think that was the first hit you had after moving to Nashville, a hit by Patsy Cline. You recorded the song yourself, and I want to play your recording of it. But first, I'd like to know if there's a story behind the writing of the song.
Well, it was one of those songs that I wrote while I was living in Houston, just before I went to Nashville, and I was playing the Esquire Club and living over in Pasadena and driving all the way over to the Hempstead Highway every night. And I did a lot of my writing during the traveling back and forth, and Crazy was one of the songs that I wrote back during that time.
Let's listen to it, written and sung by my guest Willie Nelson.
I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew that you'd love me as long as you wanted. And then someday you'd leave me for somebody new.
Do you remember what year you recorded that?
Yeah, that was that particular recording was about 1971.
It seems to me that you hold your notes longer now when you sing, that there's more sustain in your singing.
I think my lungs are stronger now. I was a heavy smoker back in those days and wasn't really in that good a condition. And that has a definite, it matters a lot in your singing if your lungs can't hold air.
When you first went to Nashville, and I think it was 1960, you describe in your book how you really didn't have much money, so you brought a siphon with you so you could siphon off some gas for the trip.
Well, we call that the Oklahoma credit card. It used to be quite used quite often back in those days.
Well, Nashville really wasn't ready for your performing. They were ready for your songwriting. You did pretty well as a songwriter. But it was very hard for you to get started as a singer. You describe even how your singing has always been behind the beat, and in Nashville people thought you lost a sense of rhythm, that you didn't know how to carry the beat.
Only the people who didn't know music.
Mm-hmm.
The ones who knew music and could count knew that I wasn't breaking meter. The musicians, the good musicians who I played with knew that I wasn't breaking meter, that it was just phrasing. Sinatra had been doing that kind of thing for a long time. It was just a little unusual to hear a guy who's supposed to be a country singer doing that. But I had listened to Frank Sinatra and all those guys all my life, and I admired their ability to phrase, and I tried a little bit of it myself on country songs, and it was a little bit different. And the guys in Nashville had just never heard it that much.
And what was different about the songs that you were writing compared to what was on the country charts in the early 60s when you were in Nashville?
Well, they weren't what they were, Nashville really wanted to call commercial songs. What they call commercial, of course, I was always afraid of that word, and got to the point where I was I hated the sound of the word commercial because they always used it at the wrong time. They always said, well, you know, that's a great song, but it's not commercial. And they said it about Crazy. They said it about several songs that I had written. I knew they were wrong, but it's hard to fight City Hall sometimes.
Well, just to give a sense of what pop music was like then, you describe how on top of the charts was Pat Boone's Love Letters and Debbie Reynolds' Tammy. Were you, did you see a way for yourself to fit in?
Well, of course, my heroes were guys like Ernest Tubb and Roy Acuff and these guys who had been on the Grand Ole Opry for a long time. Bob Wills, Lefty Frizzell, Hank Williams. I saw myself, I thought, being able to do what they were doing. And that's really all I was looking for, is just to, you know, get some exposure and be able to get a record out where I could play and work.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your songwriting and your singing, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Willie Nelson, and he's written a new autobiography titled Willie. And he also has a new album of standards. We'll be hearing some of that a little bit later. And the new album's called What a Wonderful World. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Willie Nelson is my guest. One of your friends in your book comments that in the late 60s and early 70s, it was very difficult to book you into clubs because a lot of people were intimidated or even afraid of you, partly because of the way you looked, long hair, an earring in one ear. Did that seem like a problem to you? Did you feel like your looks were alienating people who might otherwise have been booking you?
Well, when I first started letting my hair grow, I didn't really worry about whether it was going to offend anybody or not, because I had been doing what I thought the establishment had been telling me the right way to do things for a long time, and what they were telling me just wasn't working. You can't go around all the time doing what everybody tells you to do. So I decided it was time for me to start looking after my own future a little bit. And I had noticed playing a lot of the clubs in Texas that there was some young people that had sort of filtered their way into those redneck beer joints, and I noticed their hair was long, and they were trying to hide their hair under their coats, and yet they'd get out and dance San Antonio Rose and Fraulein. And this was right in the middle of the rock and roll area, and I said, well, wait a minute, there's something happening here. Maybe there's maybe the kids are liking country music for a change. And then I went to a place called Armadillo World Headquarters there in Austin and run into a lot of good country music by young people. And so I said, well, here is an audience that I'm not getting to, and maybe I should. And I played the Armadillo World Headquarters. It was so good that I called Waylon. I said, Waylon, come on down. There's something you should see down here. And there was. There was just great enthusiasm for country music coming from the young people. And that's one of the things that started things turning around for me.
Well, you mentioned Waylon Jennings and your performances together. You became known as the Outlaws. There was an album that you both appeared on that had that name as well. Did you think of that whole concept of the Outlaws as being something that was finally packaged by the country music executive, something, an idea that you had started, but a package that they found a name for?
Well, I was really sort of proud of the fact that we wasn't really going away, going along with the way that other people who didn't know us were saying that we should do our music. Mm-hmm. And if they wanted to call that a rebellion, then it was. If they wanted to call say that we were outlaws because we didn't, well, that's a good enough name. You know, I like Jesse James. They were colorful characters. We weren't robbing any banks or killing anybody, but. If calling us outlaws was a way to get us out there and get us our music exposed, I wouldn't have any objections to it at all.
Another one of your breakthroughs was a 1975 album called Redheaded Stranger. And I want to play one of your songs from that record, Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain. What was different from the sound of this album, the way you were produced, the way you sang, your choice of material, from previous albums that felt perhaps more like what you wanted to be doing?
Well, it's easy to see once you play the record that this is definitely a very underproduced song. There's just a very few musicians on there compared to Moon River that we heard a few moments ago, which has a whole studio full of musicians and voices on it. But the fact that it was a country song, I felt like it should have been treated that way, and it didn't require or didn't call for all those big arrangements. So that's why it came out the way it did. A lot of people, even the record company, said, wait a minute, this might be a good demo, but it's not, you know, I don't think it's going to be something you'd want to release as an album. And I tried to convince them that, yes, this is something I want to release as an album.
So you had to fight to do it?
Every step of the way.
Well, let's hear Redheaded Stranger. I'm sorry, from the album Redheaded Stranger. Let's hear Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain.
In twilight glow, I see blue eyes crying in the rain. Goodbye and part. I knew we'd never meet again. Love is like a dying ember, and only memories remain. And through ages, I'll remember blue eyes crying in the rain.
That's really beautiful. Did you feel like you could sing more freely too, with less accompaniment behind you, that your voice could cut through better?
Well, yeah, I still think that the simple arrangements are really the best. I want to do an album one day with just the voice and guitar. I think some other guys have done that in the past few years and been successful at it. And I really don't know whether to be successful or not, or be commercial again, as they say, but it's something that I want to do.
In the past few years, you've been recording a lot of standards, pop standards. And here's what I'm wondering about that. You describe how when you were young, you were very... You never wanted to be called a sissy, and you learned how to fight when you were really young. You learned how to be really tough. And I think to a lot of guys who are very self-conscious about that when they're young, that some of the pop songs are considered not quite manly enough. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Maybe this was different when you were growing up, but certainly after the era of rock and roll, to like Hoagy Carmichael wasn't necessarily something you'd confess to, I think, if you wanted to be like real macho. Did that ever give you pause?
No, it was never a problem for me, because when I was playing the clubs back in Texas, no one come up and said, well, I want you to do this pop standard, Stardust, for me. They would come up and say, do you know Stardust, or do you know Harbor Lights, or do you know San Antonio Rose, mm-hmm. or you know Fraulein, or Milk Cow Blues. The labels weren't in those people's minds. They were just asking for music.
A lot of the songs that you sing, both the songs that you choose to sing by others and the songs that you sing of your own, are so frequently about being vulnerable, about being rejected. Reading your autobiography, it seems like so many times it's been you who've ended up walking out on someone and who's kind of given up on marriage because you're always on the road. Do you know what I mean? Your life somehow reads different to me than the songs that you read.
Well, it's gone both ways. You know, there's been times when I've been left also, and some times when I've left. But as they say, that's what makes the jukebox play.
Are you still writing a lot of songs?
I'm still writing. I'm not writing a lot of songs. I never did write a lot of songs. It used to be if I wrote 8 or 10 songs a year, that was a big year for me. Now I maybe write 4 or 5 songs.
Are you singing more standards now because they're songs you enjoy singing or because you're writing fewer songs?
Well, both. I have put out probably 40, 50 albums, I guess, of original material, and that definitely eats up the material. So if I only did my own songs, there'd be a lot of quiet albums. By now I would have run out. I've got some songs that I've written that I haven't recorded, but at this stage of my career, it seems like that the standards, which are selling well in both markets, are being more in demand by the record company because they can get a lot of sales out of it, guaranteed, they feel, where if I handed them an album of my own original things at this point, they might say, well, you know, that's fine, Willie, but that probably won't sell over 150,000. We want something that'll sell 1 million. So, and especially since they're giving me all that money, I guess they have a right to say what they want.
Sure, I guess at this point, unless you're triple platinum, you're something of a failure compared to previous records.
Yeah, and it's really sort of a dilemma. Right now, I'm in the process of trying to figure out some way to put out these albums. The other albums, maybe a special products or something where I can do the albums that I want to do without having to worry about putting out a pop standard album, you know, every time.
It seems to me from your autobiography that you've become much more conscious of your health in the past few years. You had a lung collapse in around 1981, and it sounds like you gave up, went into a rehab clinic, gave up drugs and maybe alcohol as well.
Well, let me put it this way. I believe in moderation, and I've...
Which isn't the way you live most of your life.
It wasn't the way I lived, no, but now I believe in it a lot more than I did back then.
Yeah, you describe how you had to give up tripping on stage because you were once tripping on stage and felt like your fingers were turning into claws on the banjo and that you felt like you looked like a werewolf.
Mm-hmm, and people's heads were swelling.
Had you tripped a lot while performing, or did you give that up pretty early because it was so hard to keep the music together?
Well, yeah, it didn't take but one time to realize that's not the way to do a show. It didn't take a genius to figure that one out.
Being of superstar status now, do you feel lucky that came later in life after you'd done a lot of work and that you'd be better able to handle it?
Absolutely. I've always said that if I'd have gotten this successful back in those early years, I wouldn't have kept it. I would have thrown it away. So it's a blessing that it came later in life.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about some of your life and your music. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Enjoy talking to you.
Willie Nelson's new autobiography, Willie, is published by Simon & Schuster. His new album, What a Wonderful World, is on CBS Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with journalist William Finnegan. His new book, Dateline Soweto, tells of his illegal travels with black South African journalists covering the black townships during the press ban. I hope you can join us. Here's more from Willie Nelson's new album. This is Hoagy Carmichael's song, Old Buttermilk Sky.
Old Buttermilk Sky, I'm keeping my eye peeled on you. What's the good word tonight? Are you gonna be mellow tonight? Oh, buttermilk sky, can't you see my little donkey and me? We're as happy as a Christmas tree, headed for the one I love. I'm gonna popper the question, that question. Do you, darling, do you do? It'll be easy, so easy.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Mm-hmm.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Consider the agonies and ecstasies of Jane and Michael Stern. Throughout their adult lives, traveling through the United States searching for real American cuisine, they've savored delights like This Is It meatloaf, but they've also had to endure blackened everything and other second-rate versions of regional food. Coming up, the Sterns talk about the best and worst in American food. Also, New Orleans pianist Harry Connick Jr. is back in our weekly performance spot. And the new TV season is finally getting started. Television critic David Bianculli has reviews of 6 new shows, including Midnight Caller and Tattingers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. Vice President Bush was roundly booed today in a stop at Portland, Maine. Protesters say he's lying about the record of his opponent, Michael Dukakis. As NPR's Jim Angle reports, Bush stood his ground and said what he has to say about Dukakis is true.
In Portland, about half the crowd of 3,000 or so booed Bush and chanted, "No more lies." The vice president continued speaking, but paused for this observation.
"I don't blame these people. If I had a candidate like that that went around the United States telling everybody how bad everything was, I'd try to yell a little bit, too."
At an earlier stop in Waterbury, Connecticut, Bush said allegations he's distorting the Dukakis record is a sign of desperation in the Democratic campaign. And he defended his attacks on the Massachusetts furlough program and on an episode in which a criminal escaped and raped a woman. Dukakis points to murders committed by furloughed prisoners under Ronald Reagan when he was governor of California, and a more recent case in which a federal prisoner who received a furlough killed a young mother. Dukakis says those examples show Bush is hypocritical. Bush said Dukakis is upset not because Republican charges are false, but because the governor is weak on crime and defense. I'm Jim Angle with the Bush campaign in Williston, Vermont.
Republican Congressman Pat Swindoll went to court today, pledging to clear his name in time to win re-election next month. Swindoll was indicted a week ago on 10 counts of lying to a federal grand jury investigating his ties to a scheme involving laundered drug money. Swindoll is acting as his own counsel in fighting charges he perjured himself 10 times under questioning by a grand jury about his pursuit of a home loan allegedly tied to drug money. The Iran-Contra prosecutor agreed today to drop one of 16 charges against former White House aide Oliver North. The charge dropped involves North's alleged attempt to cover up the source of money for a security fence installed at a suburban Washington home. Walsh said the indictment on that count was not well drawn up. North's attorneys have been seeking to have a number of the indictments dropped. In one case, they said North had the right to lie to Congress because he was protecting covert operations. Special Prosecutor Walsh called that claim shocking and cynical. West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl arrived in Moscow today for a 4-day visit with President Gorbachev and other Kremlin officials. Kohl says he will raise the question of reuniting the two Germanies, but Gorbachev has said the post-war division of East and West Germany is permanent. The BBC's Jeremy Harris reports that Kohl is also traveling with a group of West German business leaders.
Chancellor Kohl was met on arrival in Moscow by the Soviet Prime Minister, Mr. Ryzhkov, and the Foreign Minister, Mr. Shevardnadze. His motorcade then whisked the West German leader through a damp Moscow to the first of several meetings with President Gorbachev at the Kremlin. The official news agency TASS said the Soviet people welcomed the visit. They hoped it would increase mutual understanding and open a new page in Soviet-West German relations. Those relations are now undergoing a rapid thaw after an icy period 2 years ago when Chancellor Kohl compared the publicity skills of the Soviet leader to those of the Nazi propaganda chief Goebbels. Chancellor Kohl is accompanied by a large group of businessmen. Bilateral trade is likely to figure prominently. Bonn is Moscow's biggest Western trading partner and could play a significant role in the Kremlin's efforts to modernize the Soviet economy.
Jeremy Harris in Moscow. A car bomb exploded outside a shopping center in South Africa today, killing 2 people and injuring at least 40 others. The blast shook the shopping complex in the mining town of Witbank, 90 miles east of Johannesburg, during the morning rush hour. The attack is the deadliest since the African National Congress guerrillas launched a bombing blitz aimed at disrupting the nationwide municipal elections. Stock prices finished lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 13 points to close at 2170.34. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. Our performer in residence, Harry Connick Jr., is back with us. At age 21, Connick is already a seasoned jazz pianist. He started sitting in with Dixieland musicians in his hometown of New Orleans when he was six. And when he was still a teenager, he played with the Marsalises, Lionel Hampton, and the late UB Blake. Connick now has a flourishing solo career. Today he's going to play a couple of standards.
I was talking to a very great singer, a friend of mine, Marion Cowings, and he was asking me if I had ever heard Jack Jones sing, and I told him that the only recording I knew of was the Love Boat theme. He sounded great on that, but Marion said, well, you have to hear him do Street of Dreams. He was about 25 years old, and I think he'll enjoy it. And I really did. It knocked me out, the fact that I had never really heard him sing, and to hear him sing so magnificently was really a thrill. So this tune is for Jack Jones, The Street of Dreams. Love laughs at a king, 'cause kings don't mean a thing. On the street of dreams, dreams broken in two can be made like new. On the street of dreams, gold, silver, and gold, all that you hold is in the moonbeams. Poor, no one is poor, long as love is sure, on the street of dreams. The street of dreams. Jack Jones, man, he sure did a good job of that tune. But anyway, I saw Jack Jones on the password game today. And speaking of password, Cole Porter is the password to this next tune I'm going to play. Cole wrote a great tune called It's All Right With Me. And right now, I would like to do this tune in the style of New Orleans piano playing. This is a great Cole composition entitled It's All Right With Me. Thank you.
Harry Connick Jr.'s second album on Columbia Records will be out later this month. On his next visit to Fresh Air, he'll play music by Duke Ellington. This is Fresh Air. Jane and Michael Stern have traveled over a million miles and gone through 17 cars searching for restaurants that still serve good regional home cooking. They've drawn a culinary portrait of America through their books Road Food, Good Food, Real American Food, and Square Meals. In their new book, A Taste of America, the Sterns have brought their readers along for the ride, sharing recipes from their favorite restaurants. When the Sterns hit the road, they look for restaurants whose character and menu bring their region to life. Over the years, the Sterns have had to develop a system for scouting good restaurants in unfamiliar places.
We have such a sophisticated system that if I tell you, it's going to sound like we're absolutely crazy, because it kind of relates to nothing except our own internal vibes, if I can use a 60s expression. For instance, Michael and I are always very leery of restaurants that have mansard roofs, you know, those sort of overhanging roofs. They usually have bad food. Why? I don't know. Also, restaurants with neon pigs or statues of pigs on the roof or in front of the door often have great food, as do restaurants with badly typed menus. For instance, there was a restaurant we saw that featured deep-fried eggplant, and their typewriter wasn't working, and so it came out as dupe-fried oop plant. And before we sat down and ordered the dupe-fried oop plant, we knew it was going to be great, and it was.
Well, that's a good system. So look for typos on the menu and pigs on the roof.
Dancing pigs, avoid mansard roofs, and when in doubt, follow the sheriff's car if you're in a small town, because the sheriff usually knows where the good breakfasts are.
I think that's a really good tip. Of course, that won't work in a big city, probably.
In a big city, what you've got to do is sniff. I mean, just open the door of the restaurant and take a whiff. We had lunch today at a restaurant that made great corned beef sandwiches. The minute we opened that door and just smelled the aroma of that curing corned beef, we knew we were in heaven.
I know you're lucky enough to have time to drive off the highway to find all these interesting restaurants. Sometimes when I'm on the road, I'm just in too much of a hurry, and I end up eating on the highway. And I think things have gotten a lot worse as far
There's
as
no
the
question.
Highway food.
Well, if you have to eat next to the highway, there are occasionally some good restaurants right by the highway exits, but that is not where the good food is. The recipes that we gathered for A Taste of America come from way off the beaten path.
We have really never intended any of our books, from Road Food to A Taste of America or Real American Food or Good Food, to be companions for the busy interstate traveler. We really are more interested in giving a culinary portrait of this country, and unfortunately, that involves traveling far from the interstate. So I think the readers of our book are really more adventurers than they are busy travelers or businessmen looking for a quick meal.
But you think things have gotten worse on the road, though? Why do you think they've gotten worse?
Well, I'll tell you one reason they've gotten worse is because in the 1930s and 40s, truck drivers used to really frequent the wonderful little mom-and-pop cafes. Since trucks have gotten so big and really can't get off the interstates except, you know, in cities to unload, the mom-and-pop cafes by the side of the road have gone out of business and have been replaced by the big truck stops. And so those little travelers' cafes that were set up for truckers or for travelers are really a dying breed, and that's kind of one reason why we've been so passionate and so serious about finding this regional American food, is because it is disappearing in many cases. And even though every time we go out on the road and find a, you know, take a new trip, we do find a new regional specialty, from something as simple as American chop suey to turtle soup in southern Indiana, a lot of the little mom and pop highway cafes have gone out of business, and we really feel that it's our job to record them and to try and keep them in business if we can by writing about them.
What keeps you on the road traveling from restaurant to restaurant?
Hunger.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, Michael and I are 41 years old now, and we started this when we were in our mid-20s, and I've always heard that one's appetite diminishes when you get older and one's ability to eat a lot of food diminishes. Well, it hasn't happened yet, I can happily say. So we still are eating, you know, five breakfasts before 9 a.m., and then we have three lunches and four dinners, and maybe my hips have spread a little bit in the 15 years, but it's... you know, it's still hunger, and we still really have the passion and energy to do it.
Your book, Square Meals, was a history, a recipe history, recipes from different eras that had all kinds of cultural insights to what life was like then. And the recipes ranged from tea room recipes to suburban recipes and to craft television theater, appetizer dip, things along those lines. Did you learn a lot about the kinds of foods you grew up on from having written that book? Did it put your childhood diet into perspective?
It really put almost much more than a childhood diet into perspective, because one of the things we found while doing Square Meals was our focus was really not even so much what people actually ate, but what they aspired to eat, what they thought they would be doing by setting oven-baked cornflake chicken on the table or tea room dainties on the table. That, to us, is what's so interesting about what you might call culinary anthropology, what it is that people are trying to say in the foods that they set before you. And I think that there lies what's really interesting about traveling around the country as well as traveling back through history about food, and that is seeing what it is that food means to people. It's a way of socializing, a way of saying something about their heritage, about their neighborhood. And I think that is really far beyond just eating something. That's what's interesting about food.
Probably you've helped inspire a lot of regional restaurants around the country, but restaurants that prepare regional food that's not from the region the restaurant's in, if you know what I mean, like Mexican restaurants in Pennsylvania and New Orleans restaurants in New York.
Yeah, I know.
Do you ever try restaurants like that are regional food, but they're not in the region that the food is from?
We generally try to avoid them just because I have nothing against them, but they're just not that interesting to us. We really try to find food of its region. We wouldn't go to Paris and look for a hamburger, or we wouldn't go to Hamburg, Germany, and look for food from Brazil. Neither do we go to Chicago and look for New Orleans cuisine. On the other hand, you know, if you're not going to be traveling, Jane and I are not purists, and I don't see anything wrong with that. It's just that they're not very interesting to us.
Yeah, I'm a little bit glad that some of the regional trends are leaving. I mean, if I see one more plate of blackened redfish or blackened something or other anywhere in America other than New Orleans, I think I'm going to run screaming out of the restaurant. But I think, you know, certainly if you live in one city, you don't always want to eat ribs if you live in Memphis. I'm sure you would get a craving for something else every now and then. But when we're on the road, we really do focus about restaurants in their own regions.
I know you recently redesigned your kitchen. Since food is a profession as well as a pleasure for you, how did you design your kitchen? What does it look like?
Well,
what were the principles you took into account before figuring out what kind of kitchen you wanted?
the principle that we would stop elbowing each other out of the way and screaming at each other every time we tried to cook, because Michael and I, it really was like making war instead of making love in the kitchen when we would cook as a couple, because we were always like stepping on each other's feet and elbowing each other and reaching over the other person who had the big butcher knife to get to the sink. So we really wanted, even though we spend all of our time together and travel everywhere together, in the kitchen we declared separate camps. And so there's the Jane part of the kitchen that has my little cooktop and sink and burner, and then there's Michael's part of the kitchen, and the Twains or the Sterns do not meet while we cook.
You see, the two of us have completely different styles of cooking. Jane is the type of cook who, as she cooks, you know, will dirty like 18 different dishes and just throw them all into the sink and clean them up sometime later. I, on the other hand, am very methodical and compulsive about it. And every time I use a dish or a measuring cup, I clean it right away. Two people who cook like that cannot cook together. And since Jane and I have to spend so much time in the kitchen testing the recipes that we get from all of these restaurants, we decided it would be better if we just had adjoining areas rather than having to share anything.
The only thing missing is a big screen or curtain that goes down the middle of the kitchen so we don't even have to see each other's mess.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Jane and Michael Stern's new book, A Taste of America, is published by Andrews McMeel. Their weekly column, A Taste of America, is carried by close to 200 newspapers. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel, see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's new on the campaign trail?
Lots. Linda Wertheimer has an interview today with Governor Dukakis, the Democratic candidate. We hear him for the first time in that interview, by the way, join in the charge against the Bush campaign that it is making racist arguments nowadays. We also hear from Gary Wills, a man who's written very eloquently and insightfully in American politics, who has now written a documentary to be seen on public television in most parts of the country, tonight on Frontline, about really the two men and the characters of each and how they were formed. That also what George Bush did today, and we have quite a bit on the campaign.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The baseball season is officially over, but the fall TV season is just beginning to heat up. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of some of the new offerings, including a timely miniseries.
Six new series show up on TV this week, including two which feature the respective returns of Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore. A couple of the new drama series are worth watching, and I'll get to them in a minute. But the week's most noteworthy offering is a six-hour NBC miniseries called Favorite Son. It's written by Steve Somer and based on his own 1987 novel. It's a political drama about a man running for president who chooses as his running mate a senator of questionable intelligence and experience, but who has the youth and charisma that might propel them both to victory. Of course, that could never happen in real life. The thing that makes it less than a direct parallel with the Bush-Quayle ticket is that in Favorite Son, it's an incumbent president, played by James Whitmore, who dumps his vice president in order to add the young senator to his re-election ticket. The senator, who's played by Harry Hamlin of L.A. Law, is the new media sensation because he just survived an assassination attempt. And the real brains behind the good-looking, slow-thinking senator is his press aide, the beautiful and manipulative Sally Crane, played by Linda Kozlowski, the female co-star of Crocodile Dundee. Favorite Son starts 7 days before a political convention and follows along two fascinating plot lines. One is the political battle for the presidency. The other is the investigation of the assassination attempt, which is assigned to a burned-out FBI agent and a naive rookie. The veteran agent, played superbly by Robert Loggia, suspects that they were chosen so that the investigation wouldn't uncover anything. And his political savvy and cynicism reflect the tough edge running through all of Favorite Son.
In 53, they had me catching commies for McCarthy. Now, McCarthy's a dirty word. In 60, they had me wiretapping a black preacher in Alabama. Now, his birthday is a national holiday. 71, I'm chasing COs into Canada. Then Carter gives them amnesty at a party at Kennedy Center. You've got some real simple ideas about right and wrong, kid. But this is Washington, and in Washington, they play a nasty little shell game with right and wrong. One year right is right, the next year right is wrong.
Favorite Son director Jeff Blechner is one of TV's best. He's won Emmys for Hill Street Blues and Concealed Enemies. In Favorite Son, he makes all the right choices, and so do Hamlin and Kozlowski. Meanwhile, Somers' story is so fast-paced, surprising, and depressingly timely that it's impossible to resist. Favorite Son runs Sunday through Tuesday on NBC. As for the other stuff this week, try out Midnight Caller on Tuesday and Tattinger's on Wednesday. Midnight Caller is an incredibly stylish show, starring Gary Cole of Fatal Vision as an ex-cop who becomes a late-night radio talk show host. The show looks and sounds jazzy, and Cole is really charismatic in the lead. So is Stephen Collins, the star of Tattinger's, which is the new show from the St. Elsewhere folks. That fact alone gives Tattinger's a half-season blank check. These guys have earned the benefit of the doubt. So even if the pilot does seem a bit too illogical and violent, the cast makes this drama about a New York restaurant worth checking out. It'll be interesting to see in the next few months where these two NBC shows will go. One other series, CBS's Paradise, is obviously going nowhere. It's a combination soap opera and horse opera that will reaffirm the notion that the Western is dead. Dirty Dancing is a CBS spinoff of the hit movie, but it has Patrick Cassidy instead of Patrick Swayze, which is crazy. And about those new sitcoms starring Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore? Well, sometimes even critics believe that if you don't have anything nice to say, the best thing to do is say nothing at all.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, the first of a two-part interview with singer David Crosby. As a member of The Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, David Crosby was one of the big names in rock music in the late 60s and early 70s. But cocaine and heroin addictions nearly killed him. He had to kick his habits while in solitary confinement on drug charges. Now he's recording again, and he has a new autobiography. Also, rock historian Ed Ward concludes his two-part profile of the Five Royals, his favorite vocal group of the 50s, best remembered for hits like Think and Dedicated to the One I Love. And book critic John Leonard reviews A Writer's America, Landscape and Literature by Alfred Kazin. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Fred Landerl, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Kathleen Frank and Joanna Simon. Joyce Lieberman is our engineer. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.